Hey, 4Play listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
4Play, presented by Barstool Sports. It is the second show of the week for us. Thursday, Transfusion Thursday. Hal Sutton's on this show. The Hal Sutton, who won 14 times on the PGA Tour, who took down Tiger Woods with one of the great self-calls in the history of the game. And he's just a legend. He was the Ryder Cup captain. He paired Tiger and Phil together. I had kind of forgotten about that a little bit until I was looking him up before just to refresh my brain. He goes into all of that and very much into the entire day, the entire history of him and Tiger Woods playing together and him taking down Tiger at TPC Sawgrass. So Hal Sutton's a guest that, like, I'm proud of having Hal Sutton on. He's a good character in golf history that hearing his perspective is something that, like, that being told on our show is very cool.
Yeah, and he's opinionated as well. We start to get into distance. We get in where the game has gone, you know, over the course of his career. He's obviously spanned a few decades, a few eras. Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, where are we at now? Like, it was great to have him on, and he just has an A-plus voice. He showed up, started talking, and I was like, his voice is better than all three of ours combined and times by 1,000. He's got that great sounding voice, which he was a great guest.
If he didn't have a fantastic career being a professional golfer, he would have been one hell of a voice actor. I mean, you throw a cartoon dog in front of him from the South with a little straw coming out of his mouth, walking out of a little doghouse being like, it's hot out here today. You know what I mean? That's yes. Fucking Hal Sutton right there. And he's a household name either way. So that guy was just given the gifts from the gods. A seasoned veteran, a guy like you're saying, Riggs, it's really just, you know, all the respect in the world to him. But, like, what the hell is that guy doing on our show? Like, that's a guy that, you know, his career, his achievements, his personality is reserved for something a little bit more, you know, polished. I'm very glad that he came on this show, though. It means that we're going places when we got someone like Hal Sutton on the show. And that, you know, that just speaks to the kind of guy he is.
Yeah, he was great. So that's coming up in a few minutes. We did almost a full hour with Hal, and he was awesome. He loves to tell stories. His voice is phenomenal. He's been a part of a lot of stuff. He's played with Jack Nicklaus. He's played with Greg Norman. He obviously played Tiger Woods. He's just got really, really good stories. So Hal Sutton's coming up here in a few.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
It's really delicious, so go check it out. Thank you, Owens, for having our back. Frankie, big win last night. This is, for folks, this is going to come out Thursday morning, so there will have been another game as well. So what we're referring to is Game 5, when the Islanders won 5-4. They got outshot a billion to, like, 19. But got it done, got the win. You guys were up 3-2. The scene at Borelli's was, as imagined, electric. I think that's the only way you could describe it, was electric. You were amazing. Stu Finer walking in like he was a Stone Cold Steve Austin entering the ring was awesome. The line outside of Borelli's was shocking. It looked like a new, like, Jordan release, or when the new iPhone comes out, people were just around, I think, the entire island of Long Island. So last night, Frankie, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, we're on a weird scheduling, like, podcast thing here where we're not recording on either the day of the game or the day after the game. People are listening to us prior to the game knowing the result, right? Like, you're hearing my voice right now. I have no idea what happened tomorrow night. We're going to the Coliseum. That's breaking news. That's not breaking news to you hearing it. So we're actually going to the Coliseum. Dave said that if we could figure out how to stream from there, we can do it. We will be streaming from the seats. I think it's going to be revolutionary. I mean, Borelli's has been unbelievable. Boston was unbelievable. But I think if we can get inside that building, get the cameras on us, even if it's iPhones, and just get those reactions in the middle of 14, 15,000 people at the Nassau Coliseum for a game, a series clinching game. The first of my lifetime. The Islanders have never played in the second round in my lifetime at the Nassau Coliseum. When they did it a couple years ago, it was at the Barclays Center. and both at the Barclays Center. Both last times I've been at the Barclays Center. So this is like the first time watching my team have a chance to go to the Eastern Conference Finals. I'm fucking jacked up. The Borelli's restaurant last night, the foundation started to slip a little bit. The place, like the floor started moving. Like I think like whatever clay or whatever Borelli's was built on in September of 1955 started to rumble a little bit. The roof had that little shake where like some fucking like stuff was coming out of the ceilings and shit. It was fucking bonkers. And the fact that that's what, like the third or fourth stream from Borelli's where it's been like that, like, or maybe third, like it's not slowing down. You'd think people would maybe get sick of it or like, all right, it's just the same thing over and over again. They're getting crazier and crazier. It's the place to watch the game. There's an argument to be made that it's just as good or better than watching it at the stadium. I mean, people are going fucking crazy in that restaurant. And what you guys see in the back room, it's triple the amount of people in the front bar and outside. Triple. Our view of the cameras, it's like, what are those little, the connecting monkeys that you get there? They're in like Toy Story. It's like the monkeys coming out of the jar. Monkeys in a jar. Is that what they are? It's like people are fucking hanging onto each other's arms, hanging off the ceiling. What are those fucking things called? Crazy monkeys? No?
Oh, boy.
The little monkeys in a jar. We all used to have them.
Dig deep, man. Come on, Trent. Figure this one out.
I'm enjoying watching Trent's brain try to find
monkey in a barrel.
Boy, it was right there for us.
Barrel monkeys.
So close. We were.
Barrel of monkeys.
Barrel of monkeys. There we go. Yes. Okay.
Barrel of monkeys.
It looks like that. It just looks like people are coming out of like the floor. It's like Planet of the Apes or something. I've never seen anything like it. And everyone's so respectful at the restaurant. There was never like anyone doing anything crazy. No one's fucking getting in trouble. It was just, you know, News 11. Pix 11 and News 12 from Long Island, they came and they were interviewing my dad, and we actually were just watching. My dad was first of all, my dad last night, we had to carry him out of the restaurant. He was absolutely ossified, like completely shit-faced.
I mean, he kept chugging bottles in John Feidelberg's face over and over again. He was pouring bottles into Stu Feiner's mouth. Like,
completely
it was
shit-faced. And
had to be.
He's sitting there like crying. They're chanting, "Mr. Borelli." He has tears rolling down.
Yeah.
It's just like, and News 11 came, and they were like, "Man!" So when we just watched it, it was on at 5:30, and the way that they edited it, they were there when it was snowing and the restaurant was closed, and my dad's sitting there in an empty restaurant, hysterically crying to the camera, being like, "This is it. Like, I don't know what to do anymore. I don't know what to do. I don't know what next month shows." And then all of a sudden it goes to black and it comes back and they show the line outside Borelli's and Mr. Borelli. And we were sitting down there all getting choked up, being like, "This is fucking crazy, Dad." Like, all the stoolies that have helped with the Barstool Fund. I mean, like, I was saying in the beginning, like, people are, like, Venmoing me so that we could bring food to hospitals. Like, every dollar helped and every donation helped to all these restaurants. And now look at the product of the people that were able to survive. You're able to – Barstool was able to have a fucking pizza review camera kid who Dave says his name a bunch of times so people know my name. I'm an Islander fan. Now I got people back in Borelli's because people want to watch the Islanders. It's just amazing what happened. And it's just crazy to take a step back and look at where we are in the world now. No one's complaining. No one's fighting anymore. It's just like fucking just good times. And my dad was like, "I lived through 4 Stanley Cups in a row, Frank." He's like, "I lived through 4 Stanley Cups in a row. I've never seen something like this at the restaurant ever. Like, this is insanity. It's insanity, guys. I the word insane isn't even registering with you guys what's actually happening at that restaurant. It's fucking preposterous.
You're going to make this podcaster cry. I mean, seeing you happy is fine. I like when the Islanders
fuck
win.
Me.
I think it's
I'm
funny to watch you go crazy. But see, what did you say?
I said, "Fuck me, I'm an asshole." Like,
yeah, that's kind of what I was getting to. But seeing your father, Mr. Borelli, happy and people chanting his name and people filling out his restaurant and seeing that place come back to life, that is a true joy.
Right.
It's really great to watch. And it's people chant Mr. Borelli's name. Like, that's really the coolest thing you could ask for, honestly.
Think about that guy. Was like sweeping the floors in an empty, dark restaurant and like probably wondering if he was ever going to hear just like tables moving and chairs moving, just that sound of a restaurant. And now he's standing in that same spot hearing radiating, echoing chants for his name because like he made it, and Barstool made it, and like the world made it. That is so fucking cool. They weren't chanting because of the Islanders. Like it was a moment of like even 18-year-old kids that were like that were in the back. They were like outside on the other side of the bar, were trying to scream in like Mr. Brett. Like even young kids knew. It was really cool to see, and it's just like it makes me just proud about like the community and Islander fans and just the world in general. It's just fucking awesome, and whatever happens with the Islanders, I care very much. But the fact that we're able to experience this, I'm just so grateful for. I really am.
Your father too, being best friends with John Feidelberg on the live streams, is one of, and Feidelberg's, you know, one of all of our favorite people on planet Earth. And so The two of them just gelling and becoming boys is one of the more heartwarming things. It's like when soldiers in like World War II were singing Christmas carols together from across the trenches. It's like those are our guys.
It's I'm trying to become less superstitious, and I think I really have been. Like, oh, I didn't want to go to Boston because the Islanders are playing at the Coliseum. I've never missed a game at the Coliseum. They're going to lose. They end up winning in Boston. And you know what I mean? Like, it's starting to just like erase from my memory that like I have no effect on the fucking hockey game. But there's a part of me that's like, when you stick my dad next to Feidelberg, the Bruins have like no chance. Like Feidelberg's guard is down now because he can't fight back the way he wants to. Even though that has nothing to do with the game, I sit there at the game and I'm like, we're okay because that guy over there, that crazy Feidelberg, he's contained. Like my dad has him in check. And like that is a huge part. Like that's momentum for us, even though it doesn't make any sense. But you know what I mean? Like watching them, they're cheersing. I'm like, oh, we got these guys.
Totally. He's killed him with kindness. He's just totally brought him in. And yeah. No, you say you're not a part of the team, and you're not, I guess. But it is funny that you have this platform where you come on and it's like a press conference where we ask you about the game. You come on and you're like, yeah, all right. Well, yeah, it was a tough game. You know, we're going to six games. Like it is, it's just the whole thing is absurd, but it's the most fun thing in the world.
Oh, I'm getting texts after big wins from the players being like, what you guys are doing at Barstool, not me, but like what's happening right now with this rivalry, and it's good for the league. I've gotten that text from multiple players, like big time players on the New York Islanders, not even just saying it's like, oh, this is awesome. They're like, dude, this is big for the NHL that, like, there's this much hype around a fucking second-round series and, like, people are lining up to get into a restaurant at 6:30 on a Monday. Like, that's pretty fucking cool that's happening.
Trent said, he's like, dude, it's not a big hockey guy. He's like, I'm glued to what's going to happen in every single game of a second-round series between Boston, which he has no tie to, and Long Island, which he has no tie to. And he's like, he's like, I wish I didn't have the fucking Bachelorette because I want to be able to watch this hockey game.
Right.
So that's just one man. That's just one person that it's affected. Man. Of course it's good for the league.
It's cool. It's just cool to hear them say that because they're also passionate about the league. And like, it's weird to hear that because like they represent the league. When the league does better, they do better, and it's just better for their kids growing up and playing and watching. So it's really cool to just see everything. The world is just getting back, man. Let's go. I fucking love it. And I hope the Islanders, I hope you guys are listening to this, and I was at the Coliseum and I watched the Islanders win. And if I didn't and they lost, you better know that I'm fucking ready for game 7. I don't want those vibes right now, but I will be ready for whatever comes my way. As a fan, I'm very happy.
Frankie, you know, we were all together, the classic crew, so we were kind of just looking at the clips. We weren't watching, like, the full stream in real time. But is it to the point, like, is it too crazy yet? Like, are people jumping up, like, grabbing your nipples or anything? Like, what is it? What is going on? Is it anything ridiculous or is it still containable?
Well, it's ridiculous, but we had security, which was great. But the fans – so I made a huge decision or improvement to my decision where everyone behind me, I basically knew every single person or I knew the person that brought those people behind us. So there was no like psychopath outliers in the crowd lurking around. Everyone was like respectful in the point where they weren't going to jump on Marina and like fucking put her in a headlock because I was nervous about that game like too, like that was going to start happening. So that was – I was at ease, but when you have a game where you score five goals and like, and you come back and like by the fifth goal, I legitimately just had nothing left. Like, it's like, how are you supposed to keep going and screaming and jumping into the crowd? Like, I started seeing black. I started seeing stars. I sat down. I like had to check my pulse. I like, we have this little finger thing that checks your oxygen level. I brought it with me. Like, I sat in the back of Borelli's and that was like a 95, which is like not good. Like, it's like kind of nerve wracking. So it's kind of, it's getting kind of crazy. I just want this to be over. I want it to fucking, I want to go on to the next round. The Lightning just won. I just got that notification. So they are the next team waiting for the Bruins or the Islanders. So it's never going to be easy. I'm happy. Thank you to all the listeners on this golf podcast that are dealing with me during this ridiculously weird and fun time in my life. I want to extend a very big thank you to you, your family, your wives, your husbands, your kids, your mother-in-laws, your moms, your dads, the whole family. You know, you don't want to hear me talk about fucking hockey all the time. I get it. But listen, it's something that I'm going through. It's my life, and I can't stop. I can't stop. I'm sorry.
I'll say it's gotten to the point at the Classics, people are asking me, how's Frankie doing? How's he handling everything? And then they're also, it's sort of become a you need to pick sides thing with anyone that's involved. So, you know, we get a good amount of people that show up from Boston that are like, you know, hey, Riggsy, like, fuck those Islanders, huh? And I'm like, nah, I'm kind of pulling for the Islanders. And like, well, fuck you, too. It like, turns into a little bit of a thing because it's you know, capturing so many people. But it's good. It's like that's like you said, it's good for the game. People, this is why we watch sports. This is why we get so jacked up for whether it's somebody we like in golf or we talk about the Rider. Like, having a team that's in it that means a lot to you is what being a fucking sports fan is. So it's very cool. Good luck. I am rooting for the Islanders. I don't like the Boston Bruins, especially ever since you know, our series against them a few years ago, that you're just going to build in those rivalries. And then the added aspect of Mr. Borelli, Stu Fienter, you.
Oh, Stu Fienter. Unbelievable. He's unbelievable. It's I was sitting around before, I think, game two. Whatever game he came to. Yeah, I guess game two. I was like, how do I get some more firepower here? Because game one was a nightmare. And I was like, I just looked at Stu. I saw him come up on Twitter. Like, didn't even know if he was going to say yes or if he's an Islander fan or anything. I was like, do you want to come tonight? And he wrote back, I fucking love you. I'll be there like a raging bull or whatever he wrote. And he hasn't stopped, man. He has not stopped.
You were looking for any sort of firepower, any sort of weapon, and you just came upon a nuclear bomb and carried it into Borelli's with you. And you're like, this is what I have now. He's as much energy as you can pack into one body.
And his like sons are, my cousins went to school with all his kids. And so they're able to, he knows my family. He knows my aunt. He's kissing her on the cheek. He's kissing my cousin that he coached in baseball on the cheek. I haven't seen you in fucking 13 years. Look at this guy. He never lets off the gas. He's insane. No. And his kids are great. His son is unbelievable. He makes sure Stu's in the right spot and Stu doesn't get all out of control. It's fucking, the whole thing's just a, what an experience. But
the fact that all of these things are part of the same stream.
It's
like your dad, you, how crazy you are. Oh. Stu Fienter, and he actually is a million notches above you guys. Marina is like a silent assassin type crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And the fights is like, a lunatic, a lovable lunatic who's, but the whole thing, and then and we haven't even gotten to the fan. So, yeah, it's just, it's the
best.
Should
be fun.
Good luck. We're rooting for you guys.
Hockey is on. And no matter the city, no matter the team, no matter the game, whether it's face-off or penalty shots, regular season or playoffs, win or lose, no matter what happens, no matter where it happens, New Amsterdam Vodka is there.
A few things in the world of golf before we get to Mr. Hal Sutton. Bryson and Brooks update. Bryson said essentially that he just thinks that their little feud, their little rivalry is good for golf, which is kind of the high road that we thought he was going to take or that he was going to attempt to take. He said, I think a good jesting rivalry is good for the game of golf. Nothing too extreme. DeChambeau said of the Rocket Mortgage Classics Media Day, but at the same point, and time. That's all outside of the spectrum of what we're here for today. And I think the most important thing is to be talking about what Rocket Mortgage is doing for the 313 area. And I think the Change the Course initiative is something that's bigger than the game of golf compared to a rivalry. So he literally took like the most high road that you could possibly take, talking about what, you know, a sponsor is doing for a community, which is right on brand with Bryson, and he always brings up his sponsors whenever he wins. So just a super Bryson, almost laughably like caricature Bryson response from Bryson, which is kind of what we've grown to expect from Bryson.
A good jesting is the most Bryson DeChambeau way to refer to like a beef, a social media beef or the beef that he has going on with Brooks. But he's talking about this thing that's going on with him and Brooks in a way that he doesn't engage in what's going on. He's simply giving a summary of what's happening. And it's a lot about what we talked about on last show, how this is a guy who no longer wants to be involved in this, to the point now where he is taking the highest road he can find. And instead of getting into the mud, as we call it here at Barstool Sports, when asked about this, he instead talks about what is going on with this thing with Brooks. He could be throwing jabs and barbs in these interviews, but instead he's like, I don't want to be involved with this, so I'm now just going to talk about what is going on and what it could potentially lead to. So it's more the same, and I think we're going to get, this is the line of thinking we're going to get from Bryson throughout this whole thing until it's over, I guess.
Yeah, more of the same for sure. I mean, this is just right out of the Bryson playbook. The only play now that we don't know yet, like we can always foresee what Bryson is going to do. He's never going to step out of the line. He's always going to say something that's just like embarrassingly soft in response. And we're going to be like, oh man, it's starting to get a little sad that he can't just like fire back because that's just not how he's built. And the only thing we don't know that we cannot predict is what Brooks will do next. Will he continue to keep the foot on the gas? Will he continue to be a little bit like corny and lame with some of the things that he does? Will he continue to be just mean? Will he continue to do all that stuff? Or will he just like give up? And that's something we just don't know what he's going to do yet. I genuinely think he probably will give up at this point after we've last talked. Just because so many people on Twitter had that same thought that we did, where it's just like, at some point, man, like you're appealing to some people where you're just going to like keep hammering him home, foot on the gas, kill him, make him quit golf forever. Like, and like part of me would probably always be like that kind of person where it's like, bury him. I mean, I did say that Tiger should make Abraham Answer, never play the game of golf again. Like, I love carnage. I love making people cry. But like, man, like, there's a lot of people saying, like, all right, this is, like, just weird now.
Yeah, I guess, you know what a question we've never asked in regards to this situation is, what's the end goal for a guy like Brooks? And I understand, like, the motivation right now is he clearly gets under this guy's skin when the guy who he's getting under the skin of claims that it's not getting under his skin. And the feedback that Brooks is getting right now from social media largely is, like, Brooks is killing this guy, and it's very funny, and oh, this is amazing, and that's got to feel good. That's got to trigger some dopamine in Brooks's brain, being like, I am dominating this guy in such a way that people are loving it. But like, where do we go? Where does it end? Where do we stop?
I think you can ask that with any like rivalry or debate. I don't know that we ever know like what the final like outcome is. Like when I'm fighting with a friend or anything, or I have a rivalry of someone that I genuinely don't like, I don't know what I'm seeking when I'm either being mean or avoiding them, or like, what do I want them to die? I don't know, like, what the like what is the answer? I don't know, like, what, yeah, like, do they, yeah, like,
no, you're right.
Does he want him to like submit like his golf clubs to him and be like, you win?
Yeah, you're right.
Bryson, like, I am Bryson DeChambeau, and I submit my one length iron golf clubs to you. You now have the one length irons. Here's my protractor. I am done playing the game of golf. You win. It's like Brooks is like, yeah.
You're right. And Brooks probably doesn't know what he doesn't have an end goal. He's just having fun with this scenario. But it is like, what are we heading towards? And there is no answer, I suppose.
There is no answer. You can ask any bully that in high school, or you can ask whatever. It's like, what do you want that other person to do?
Because even the scenario where you're like, bend the knee, and you're obviously going far with like quit golf, but he has bent the knee. He's like, I don't necessarily want to be involved in this anymore.
Well, the only outcome is that Brooks wants to just be liked more. It's like a, you just keep going up, keep going up, keep going up. Oh, if I make this joke about Bryson, I'm going to get more followers. I'm going to get more likes. I'm going to get more laughs, more podcast appearances. I'm going to do this, blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, I'm going to keep doing it.
That's probably Bryson. The best answer, yeah.
Yeah.
And Bryson said, like, I've personally got no issue. It's something that he's up for discussion. If you want to talk to Koepka about that, you can, but I've got no issues. And then even Spieth said, you know, about the whole Brooksy issue at the Memorial, he said, any bad hole, someone was yelling Brooksy, and then any good hole, people were yelling, go Bryson, almost louder than the Brooksy stuff. It was like a pseudo-rivalry, and Koepka wasn't even there.
Yeah, which is, you know, the pseudo-rivalry. What is the definition of pseudo?
Like fake?
Fake.
Fake? Okay. Yeah, because I thought that that's what he was, you know, referring to. And at that point, I mean, it is a real rivalry at this point.
It's real. It's
Jordan.
What's up, boys?
Whoa. Just an all-time lurch move to just pop in out of the clouds. In yeah, it's just lurch. Hey, lurch, right. What's up?
How are you doing? Good to see everybody. Everybody's looking swell. Yeah, just massive a travel day. Just another one. Leaving O'Hare. Nobody likes O'Hare.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough because the listeners, they don't even know what you're talking
about.
They have no clue what you're talking about.
It's pretty awesome.
I didn't know if you guys, because I was going to join 10 minutes ago. But anyways, I was traveling from Charlotte to O'Hare. Just got off the plane. Was hoping to join about an hour ago. However, that wasn't the case because I just got stuck in weather delays, traffic. My buddy, my rep, who's sitting right here next to me, did the classic speed up to slow down situation. He ran, got the rental car. I got the bags. That just took more time. So anyways, now I'm just way behind schedule, but it's good to see everybody's faces.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it's nice to see your face too. Is it, you know, it looks like, is it the sun still up there somehow? Is that what's going on here?
No, I think those are actually pretty beautiful sky. I'm not going to turn it, but gorgeous little rainbow. And kind of cotton candy sky kind of shimming off the glass. But I don't mean to interrupt the conversation around pseudo. That seemed riveting.
Yeah, we're discussing, you know, a little Brooks Koepka, Bryson DeChambeau, you know, the latest and some Spieth comments, and then, you know, your mug just kind of appeared on our WebEx, so there you were.
I saw a couple smiles and then Frankie looked to the side. Frankie, you getting ready for battle tomorrow?
Yes. I'm not going to get into it because we just talked about it, and I think people are going to fucking strangle me. But yes, I am. We're in the Coliseum, so I'm just very grateful to be there, and it'll be fun.
Well done. Good luck.
Thank you.
But yeah, I think more of the same. I think that's pretty much what it looks like right now with Brooks and Bryson. I think everybody understands that. I touch on Ricky Fowler. Ricky Fowler missed out on U.S. Open qualifying by a shot in terms of getting into a playoff. Will not play at Torrey. He is, of course, part of the same stable as our very own Trent Ryan when it comes to notable players who are underneath the expertise of golf instructor John Tillery. So you, Trent, is this a personal setback for kind of your stable and your crew, or how do you feel about it?
No, I don't feel that way at all. John Tillery is obviously a great swing coach, and Ricky's been playing well recently. He played well at Kiowa. He played well at the Memorial. Obviously, he'd love to be playing in the U.S. Open. He didn't play in the Masters. He hung out at Tiger's house. But, like, I think in terms of what it's like to be Ricky Fowler right now, it's not nearly as bad as it has been in the past few months. Like, before he played well in the PGA Championship and then again at this last weekend, people were just like, oh, like, I don't know what's going on with Ricky Fowler. You know, it's just crazy. But I think it's fine. It certainly doesn't hurt the JT John Tillery stable. Like, I'm on the up and up. He's on the up and up. Things are looking good for us.
Yeah, because, I mean, at one point, you know, Ricky Fowler was taking direct shots from Cernik Faldo on Twitter about not, you know, playing in the Masters. And now he is on the up and up. He finished tied for eighth at Kiowa. He played very well at the Memorial, like you said. And he played well. It's really hard to get through U.S., you know, that especially that sectional qualifying the U.S. Open, and he missed it by just one shot with, I think it was a little chip on his last hole that came up a roll short. He obviously had a good attitude about it. He always does. But I was just curious if you have some, you know, special bond now, you feel like, with Ricky Fowler as like the same man that has sculpted and will be sculpting Ricky Fowler's game is using those hands to sculpt our very own Trent Ryan as well. So I didn't know if that kind of led to something.
You know, unfortunately, I've never had any personal interaction with Ricky Fowler. Neither has this show, where we'd be more than happy to have him on at any point if he wants to come on. But in terms of, we're kind of all pulling for the same thing where I want John Tillery to be happy, and I think Ricky Fowler shares that same sentiment. So if I play well and if Ricky Fowler plays well, again, we're part of the same stable. So if we both end up playing well, then John Tillery is happy, and I think that's really the ultimate goal. Maybe the ultimate goal might be breaking 100, breaking 90. Ricky's goals might be a little different than that, but at the end of the day, when John Tillery can look at the guys in his stable and be happy about what's going on with them, I know that brings him peace, and that's kind of the goal that we're all pulling for.
Do you think you, when you achieve breaking 100, you'll get maybe a message from your stable partner?
You know, I don't have any expectations about that. I will be honest, and I haven't been messaging Ricky about his recent success at Kiowa and at the Memorial. So
I think
you should.
Oh yeah, let me do that right now.
You know what, Trent? I think you fucking should.
Here we go. Yeah, if we're all going to be part of the same stable, it seems crazy that we're not connected at some level. I'm going to get on his Instagram.
How are you gonna start this message? Like, what's up, partner? What's up, bro?
What's up, stablemate?
Okay.
Oh, that's a good one. Is that going to be on Twitter?
No. No, I'm going to do a private DM on Instagram.
Are you really going to write stablemate?
You don't think that's a good lead?
I love it. I fucking love it. I think it's so preposterous that
here's
he
what
to
I'll
answer.
Do. Here, cuz that might confuse him. It might disorient him a little bit. So I'll say hey, stablemate, and then in parentheses I'll put John Tillery.
yeah,
that's how good. I do it. That makes the most sense.
Really good, yeah.
Hey, stablemate, is that one word or two?
I think you rip whatever.
I think it's either, just whatever looks more natural.
It's looking like one.
I do very much enjoy it when I scroll through John Tillery's like Instagram story, and it'll be like two or three up closes of Kevin Kisner, and then the next one is like Trent Ryan, you know, stretching upside down on a fucking door, and you guys are just part of the same team, man. Like, he's trying to get all these same people to play better golf, and you're part of that.
It was funny that I sent John or JT a text the other day, and he's a little bit in my school where he's okay at responding to text messages. He's like, I could kind of see why people they get frustrated with me sometimes, but then I saw on his Insta story that he was working with kids, and I was like, oh, he's just working with one of my stable mates. So it's like, if they're out there grinding, he probably is not looking at his phone too much.
Where are we at with the crafting of this message?
All right, so I'm at hey stable mate, in parentheses, John Tillery. So I think I probably have to lead with the most recent event where he missed out on the qualifying by one stroke. So I want to be like, what do I say next?
You know, tough one this week, but really like where things are heading for the team.
Yeah,
great showing at PGA and again at the Memorial. Things are looking up.
Feels like both of our games are on the up and up or something
yeah.
like that.
Just
group yourself into that.
Along the lines of like, yeah, you guys are in it together, that you kind of mutually share each other's success and improvement in golf is how you got to frame it.
I definitely want to end it on something like, I want to allude to just how frustrating the game of golf is and how we're connected on that level.
To that same point, do we have that TaylorMade tour bag still that's foreplay? Because I would love to put Trent Ryan's name on that and get that in JT's just in the stall. So you're looking at like Ricky.
Now we're talking.
You know,
solid.
Kisner, Trent Ryan.
Now we're talking. We're going to start working on that for sure.
But
no
I
doubt.
Think here's – hold on. But like – when we were at the Kingdom, you know, they said that you can't get one of those bags at the Kingdom unless you win a major. So maybe, like, can Trent not get one of those bags in JT's facility until he breaks 100?
Yes, that is correct.
Yes, that's fine. But as soon as he does, it's just right in front of Ricky's face when he goes to drain. He's like, how the hell? This could be our first in with Ricky.
And there's also pictures of of, you know, like when Kisner's won, he takes a picture with the trophy. I would like, not only would I like the tour bag in the facility, because that's a great idea. I'd also, I want to hold a piece of paper, like Wilt Chamberlain-esque, when he scored 100. Yeah. Whatever I shoot, 99, 98, 91, whatever. I want to keep holding that up, and then I'm going to take a picture. I'm going to have that framed, and I want JT to put that up in his little bay there. I think that'd look good, too.
Yep.
Is a video coming out tonight? Is Jake in the background yet? Yeah, tonight. We haven't even talked about that yet. Tonight, and while you construct this Instagram message, Trent, we have to promote this on YouTube, BarstoolSports.com. Trent Ryan makes his first attempt post John Tillery surgery and physical therapy and everything that he went through in Georgia. This is his first attempt. We are at Brookville Country Club. This is where we met a bunch of cast of characters. And you're going to see just maybe the best, you know, there is so much drama. It's the best type of like movie atmosphere of Trent trying to break 100. There's highs, there's lows.
Thank you. Par 72, or what is the length of the course?
I believe it was a par 71. I think we played it from like 67, 6800.
Okay. It's a good test.
I could have just made all that up, but Joe LaCava was there.
He was.
This is the Joe LaCava round.
Joe LaCava was there, and it was quite the scene. Joe LaCava is on certain greens watching Trent putt. He wants to know everything about it. So, yeah, you're going to want to watch this, because the first video, if you watch the first video, you now are a part of this journey.
Yes, you are. You're locked in. You are invested in Trent Ryan, much like, you know, people are invested in John Tillery's stable, which is why Trent Ryan is crafting a message to his stablemate, Ricky Fowler, right now. But go to our YouTube channel, check out Trent's first episode of actually trying to break 100. This was one, too, that on the podcast got a lot of play, because you guys were telling and teasing the things that occurred during that day. I remember our group text was popping because people, you know, you guys couldn't believe the scenario, the situation, the things that occurred that day. And now we're going to get a lot of it in the video. So I, for one, I'm ready to take this journey with Trent. And as a viewer that has not seen any of the footage, that has not been there for any of these rounds, that wasn't there in Georgia, I am like you out there listening, and I have just hopped on to this vessel, and I am floating down the river of the journey that is Trent Ryan trying to get better at golf, and I'm witnessing all of this with you literally in the same boat, and I cannot wait for tonight's episode to see how my friend Trent progresses in his game, because I've heard whispers that, you know, it's really interesting to watch. Hips are fucking moving. I mean, things are happening.
I think if you see, there's a voice crack. I think if you see, I'm excited to see one of these new swings where if the confidence stays and those hips are firing, that's going to be all time. I mean, that's going to be the most exciting swing in all of golf. I think we all believe certainly that you can break 100. I think even if you missed the first video, go back and watch it, because rooting for Trent to break 100 is just rooting for the good guys in golf. And I'm all for it. I can't wait. I mean, you've got the putting down. Hopefully that maintains or holds it up, because what we saw at the Olympic was, yowzer, was that bad. But it's there. It's in the bag. Go Trent Ryan.
Trent, all right. Let's read this message out loud.
I got a little bit of writer's block once we – all right. This is the message that I want to send to Ricky Fowler.
Do you still just have, hey, stablemate?
No, I got more than that.
It seems like not much.
No. I got, hey, stablemate, in parentheses, John Tillery. Tough one this week, but it seems like the game is heading in the right direction. Great showing at the PGA and the Memorial. Golf is a frustrating beast, but we've got the best swing coach in the world, and now I'm stuck.
Right. I mean, I think that's too much already. Like, if you got that, would you read that whole message?
If it was from my stablemate, yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's too much. I liked, you know, I think you really have to talk to him like a teammate, not like a guy who wants to talk to Ricky Fowler. So you want to say, like, hey, stablemate, John Tillery, tough one this week, but we have things trending in the right direction. Great.
Yeah,
like,
that's good.
We have things trending in the right direction. You look good in... You look good at the USO at the PGA.
Say loved what I saw at the PGA and the Memorial.
Yeah, Loved, or maybe loved what we saw. It's like you and JJ.
Loved what we saw.
That's a huge team thing. Loved what we saw at the PGA and the Memorial. We all know this game. Dot, dot, dot. Let's keep trending in the right direction. If you want to say something about like how the game, I know that you're like stuck on. You want to say the game is tough. So like,
your first bit, Frankie, was spot on. I think we can tweak the back end of that. But I like loved what we saw. I think is brilliant. Like the inclusive comments and making it a team aspect is spot on.
I did. Yeah, I liked all of that. Honestly,
yeah. You just addressed the whole thing. Like it's you guys are one unit together. Like it's not him, you separate. Like Frankie said, you gotta eradicate any language that makes it seem like you just want to talk to Ricky Fowler, and include all language that's like, we got this, buddy. We're doing great.
Yeah, I think it's as simple as saying like, we got this, man. Let's keep this thing rolling. Like that's just like, and we all fucking run out into the field. I don't think you overthink it anymore. I think you just fucking write that down, read it out loud, and let's fucking get on our way. 2 hours into this podcast, I think we fucking send that thing.
All right. Hey, stablemate, John Tillery. Tough one this week, but we have things trending in the right direction. Loved what we saw at the PGA and the Memorial. We got this, man. Let's keep this thing rolling.
Send it.
Fucking send it to your teammate, man.
Send it
that's
to
your
stablemate.
That's your stablemate. Just
Hashtag Till Gang or no?
No. Yes. I like it. Yeah. Well, wait. Is that something you want to live with?
Hashtag Till Gang is incredible.
Is that something that's going to stick? Is that something that's going to stick? Because that's going to stick now. That's going to stick. Till Gang is now.
Gang.
Okay.
Till Gang.
That's it.
Till Gang is perfect.
Hashtag Till Gang.
That's a good hashtag.
I'm gonna get a text from JT being like, "Hey,
Hashtag
Till Gang is fucking fantastic. Shirt.
We got this, man. Let's keep this thing rolling. Hashtag Till Gang. Okay.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good message.
Fucking fire.
I just sent it
to Ricky Fowler.
Yeah, to Ricky Fowler.
I love that. I want to say, whoo, man, that made me laugh really hard. Till Gang is so good. I want to, you know, we're doing Barstool Classic down here. We've had Uncle Chaps, one of my favorite people in the world, who's been here for a couple days. I hadn't seen Uncle Chaps in like a year and a half. He led, actually. This is a big ice cream sundae crew. He led dinner on Sunday night when I hadn't seen him. First order. Not appetizer or whatever. He just led with an ice cream sundae.
No way, dude.
Which I've just never seen that before. You know,
did he make an announcement like an upside down dinner? Because I've done that before, but or did he just
He just like, you know, I was like, yeah, we'll do some chips and salsa, and then Chaps like, yeah, let's do ice cream sundae.
And what was his next part of his meal?
What? He got like a fruit salad.
Dude, what the fuck, man?
It was, and he said, he's like, man, I'm a really busy, like, father of two who never leaves anywhere, goes anywhere, and I'm here by myself for a couple days. I'm going to get whatever I want, and right now I want an ice cream sundae, so that's what I got, and it was awesome.
I guess, like, why beat around the bush? You know at some point you want that ice cream sundae, just rip it right off the top.
It was heroic, and he said, he's like, you know, a lot of times I just get too full, and I'm not able to fully enjoy the dessert part of the meal, so I just led with it, and it was a heroic move. He was great to hang out with for a couple of days. Will Compton from Bussin' with the Boys came down. He's such a nice dude, was interacting with everybody, was shaking hands, talking a lot just about, you know, his status and, you know, being in Nashville and chilling with everybody. And then Weather Girl Hannah was here, who's getting very into golf, who has a pretty good golf swing, by the way, and is going to be a problem, I think, because people are going to chirp that she's better than us. But the whole crew down here just kind of getting through the Classic in Austin. A couple Texas stops been really hot, has been phenomenal. So I just wanted to shout that crew out. And we're on our way to a Penn property, La Berge, in Lake Charles. On Thursday, so when people are listening to the show,
Lake Charles, where's Lake Charles?
Louisiana.
Okay. Unbelievable. Yeah, I've heard that we have a great property in Louisiana for Penn National. I've heard that multiple times. Great golf course. I've heard that from Penn people. When I first met them, they heard that I was a golfer and we had a golf podcast. They're like, oh, man, wait until you get down to Lake Charles.
Dude, they got a bunch of stuff lined up for us. So, you know, when we were at the M in Vegas, we were all excited because all the amenities, but things weren't quite fully open. Our rooms were insane and so cool. And they have, I think they're rolling it out even better for this because things are like reopened now. So we're really excited. They got some stuff planned. We got like a full itinerary on Wednesday. So I can't wait to get to the Penn property there, La Berge, and just check it out in Lake Charles. So it's going to be a great time. Barstool Classic rolls on. We're getting close to halfway through the whole thing. We're not quite there yet. Dude Wipes is a sponsor of the Barstool Classic. They've been there pretty much since the beginning. And we got to have a serious chat about bathroom habits. I imagine this crew, you know, knows quite a lot about bathroom habits. Time to quit scratchy toilet paper. That'll ruin.
The High Noon El Prez Pack is here, featuring my top four High Noon Vodka Seltzer flavors. These flavors include passion fruit, pineapple, pear, an all-new flavor, tangerine, all made with real vodka, real juice. This 12-pack is only here for a limited time, so get it while you can. Just look for the pack with my face on it. You can even scan the QR code in the pack and have me virtually join your party. Visit highnoonspirits.com to find the El Prez Pack nearest you.
All right. That is a really good way to bring in now an incredibly special guest who is legitimately awesome. I think people are going to be here pumped to talk to him. He's just one of those guys, like, I would have never thought we'd have Hal Sutton on. He's such an interesting character. He's been a part of such interesting things that have happened in the last, you know, 20, 25 years of golf. So here is Hal Sutton. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're joined by one of my favorites. I honestly, just one of my favorite guys to watch. He's got a phenomenal record, resume when it comes to golf. Major champion, 14-time PGA Tour champion. He's won the Players Championship twice, won the PGA Championship at famed Riviera, and he is the caller of one of the most famous calls in the history of golf. Hal Sutton, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it. Glad to be on with y'all.
Yeah, we are. We're pumped for this one. We've been kind of talking in our group, but I can't even imagine. I mean, I know you named your podcast after it, but I can't even imagine how many times in a week or so you probably hear "Beat the Right Club Today."
Well, you know, in the golf environment, a lot of people know the phrase and use the phrase, and as I say all the time, I'm glad I was able to give that phrase to the golf world. You know, it was an iconic moment for me. I mean, that came out of a moment of passion, to be honest with you. I didn't want to have to play another hole against Tiger. I'd gone far enough. So
incredible. No, I mean, it is. It's and it's rare. I mean, in any sport, like, a call is usually known for an announcer, Jim Nantz. This is like the guy that hit the shot called his own shot, and it's just so good.
Well, it was, you know, to be frank about how that came about, I hit the shot, I had the yardage, I hit the club exactly the way I wanted to hit it. It's headed right at the hole, and I knew the only thing that could keep me from winning that tournament at that point was something out of my control, wind or something. And, I mean, I'm just looking at it thinking, please be what I'm seeing, you know.
Was that
like a go-to line for you, like, growing up playing, or is that something that just came out of the blue?
That came out of the blue. I have no idea where it came from. It just, you know, it's in the air, it's headed right at the flag, and I'm thinking, do not fool me, just be what I what I'm looking at.
That's amazing.
Well, I tell you, not long after that, y'all remember Tom Watson hit the perfect shot at the British Open, and somehow it went over the green.
Yep.
And that's how, I mean, we're splitting hairs out there. All these guys today, they're splitting hairs. And, you know, it can just as easily go the other way.
We actually just brought that scenario up recently when we were talking about analytics, right? Like you can have all the perfect numbers written down on a sheet of paper. You can know exactly what club to hit on what certain day, on what certain pin, on what certain hole. But at the end of the day, you can hit the perfect analytical shot, and something that, you know, nature or something that you couldn't control is going to happen to that ball, like Tom Watson, and it can cost you a major championship. It really makes you think about the game and that the level of impact in nature has.
Well, I think that's what we love about the game as golfers. You know, we love the fact that we know we can't perfect it, and you know, trying to learn how to control the things we can control and stop trying to control the things that we can't control. That's the beauty, and that's the art of the game right there.
And you know, that year too, 2000 is known for Tiger Woods and maybe the best year of golf that's ever been played. He took down everybody that year. He's beating people by 15 shots, by 8 shots. And at one of the more iconic venues in the world, you know, you stood up to him in one of the very few that went toe-to-toe that took him down. You know, like for you looking back, you know, historically and in context, like how impressive, you know, for yourself even is that to look at now?
Well, you know, TPC, power's not the most important thing at Sawgrass. You know, Pete Dye, all of his golf course, he designed where it's point A to point B to point C. And I did that pretty darn good. And at the time, I was playing really, really well. And, you know, I knew that I could beat him. You know, the night before the last round, in the press tent, they're trying to tell me every reason why I should succumb. And I finally got up and I said, look, I said, you know, this morning when I was saying my prayers and I was on my knees, I said, I was not praying to Tiger Woods. That makes him a man just like me. And we'll go out there and we'll settle this tomorrow. Enough said. And, you know, I just was fed up with the way the world was handling Tiger at the time. And, you know, the week before he had beat Davis Love. Davis had a 3-shot lead on him at Bay Hill, and Tiger came back and beat him. And Colin Montgomery had told everybody in the press tent that week that everybody was playing for second. Nobody could beat Tiger. And the world needed to know someone could beat Tiger. And, you know, I felt like I was not only playing for Hal Sutton, I felt like I was playing for you and everybody else that was a golfer, because, you know, that's what we love about golf is the competition. People trying to win golf tournaments, being close to winning and losing, not just, you know, predetermined.
And if you gave me like a pump-up speech every morning, I would be the most successful human being on earth. You're like giving me chills the way you talk about that, about like he's just a man. Like, let's go out there and beat him. It's awesome. It's just so – and it makes sense because you went out there and you did it. You didn't back down. You hit awesome golf shots. Giving me the chills. We're all big Tiger guys. I think you probably are too, but it's just giving me the chills.
Well, let me tell you, there's even more to this story than you may know about. The year before in 99, I'd played really, really well. And I called my caddy, Freddie, and I said, in December, and I said, I want you to come into my office. And so he comes into the office and I said, Freddie, I said, somewhere on the West Coast, we're going to get paired with Tiger Woods the first 2 days. I know it's coming. And I said, I have a mission for both of us. We've got to beat him both rounds. And Freddie says, well, why is that important the first 2 days? And I said, there's three people that need to know this can be done. You, me, and Tiger. And I said, I can't control what Tiger thinks, but I said, I know that if you see me beat him twice and I see me beat him twice, the next time we get paired with him, we know we can do that. So as luck would have it, Riviera, the first two rounds, I'm paired with Tiger. And I beat him the first round and I beat him the second round. And, you know, it was part of a plan. I knew that was coming one day. I was lucky that it actually happened at TPC where power wasn't the most important thing.
And so you know in your head, you know, you've almost got this premonition that, hey, we're going to get paired together. And B, like, not only are we going to get paired together, but it's going to mean something for something even more important in the future, which turned out to be the final round of one of the biggest tournaments in the world, the Players' Championship. So you know, it's incredible that it came true. But I love that, you know, for average civilians like us, right? Like, we're just talking about golf and trying to get better. We're breaking 100, breaking 80, whatever we're trying to do. And, you know, you're out there almost doing all these calculations, you know, the mental approach, knowing, right? Like, I feel like you now knew that Tiger knew when you stood on that tee, on the first tee at TPC Sawgrass, like, Tiger knew, oh, this guy can actually beat me.
Well, I think he and I have never talked about that, but I think Tiger knew he was going to have to beat me, that I wasn't going to beat myself. And, you know, that's all we really can control is what we're doing. We can't control what the other guy's doing. You know, if Tiger jumped out there and shot 63, the likelihood of me beating him would have probably been slim and none. But it wasn't the kind of golf course that was going to give up a 63 at the time. And, you know, I felt good about it.
It also speaks to the figure that Tiger was at that time, that he's such a myth that you are taking it upon yourself to be like, no, we have to prove to the world that it is possible to beat this other human being. He's no different than us. He just happens to be really good at the game of golf. Where does that confidence come from, where you say to yourself, I'm going to be the guy that proves to the rest of the world that this guy isn't invincible, that he can be beaten?
Well, I didn't, you know, when I just felt like I was going to get the chance one day, and I wanted to be prepared for the one chance that I get. And it kind of, you know, likens the other day when Phil won at PGA, you know, I think Phil knew I might not ever get another chance to do this like this. I've not seen Phil as focused as I saw him in that back nine. He's looking around at everything normally. And, you know, he looked very focused to me, as if to say, I'm not going to let this slip away. And it takes that sort of intent to be able to have a victory like that.
How did you, you know, in Tiger Mania, everything that comes with that, the circus, sometimes they start moving when you haven't even putted out yet because people were focused on Tiger. What did you do personally, individually, to stay in it, to play your game, and to ensure, you know, that you had that same 100% focus on all your shots?
Well, I mean, to me, golf is playing one shot at a time, and my only goal was to drive it down the middle of the fairway on the first hole. And I tried – my goal was to match him shot for shot. And, you know, I don't remember – I'm not sure I missed any fairways that day. And I only missed one green. I missed the eighth green. And my goal was to make sure that every time I hit a shot, he was looking, that ball was going right where we wanted it to go. And that kept pressure on him. I didn't want to open the door for him. And the one time that I got close to opening the door was on the hole that I missed the green. It was on number eight, the long par three. And Pim was back left, and I was trying to sneak it back there on the left side, and got over the hill and into the bunker, rolled all the way across the bunker to the backside of the bunker. I couldn't even stand in the bunker. And Tiger was up in front of me. He walked over there, and I can remember he looked at the shot, turned around to Stevie, and he shook his head no, you know, as if to say he's dead. And when I couldn't stand in the bunker, you know, I'm squatted down really low, and I told myself, just stay left. Whatever you do, stay left. And I hit absolutely – I mean, I spent 25 years out there. It was the greatest shot I've ever hit in my life. And, I mean, it popped up perfect, soft, landed right where I wanted to, and went about 8 feet past the hole, which, you know, somebody would have said, I'd have given a whole lot of money for 8 feet past the hole before I hit that shot. And, you know, I made the putt, and we're walking to the ninth tee, and Tiger said, man, that was a hell of a shot right there. And, you know, that told him, I'm not going to go away. And, I mean, that's what he's done over and over again in his whole career, is he's hit that shot that was miraculous when he needed to hit it. And it was one time that it got done to him. So,
yeah, I was going to ask if you guys spoke much, you know, during that round at all.
Yeah, you know, some. It was really funny. It got rained out. I don't know if you remember, we were on the 12th hole and it rained it out, and we had to finish on Monday. And we went out and warmed up, and I got in the van before he did. And I'm sitting up in the seat right behind the driver, and he gets in behind me. And I'm sitting there. I hadn't said anything to him. You know, he's right behind me. And he reaches up and just grabs me really hard with both hands on both shoulders. He said, "Man, I had no idea there was this many rednecks in North Florida." He said, "And they're all for you." I said, "Tiger, now you know how the rest of us feel."
Right.
That's so good. You just don't know how, and us again, like, we don't know what it's like inside those ropes. So it's cool. It's cool to hear that. And you guys are, I mean, you're people out there, right? You're just people playing golf, trying to win a golf tournament. Yeah. So it's cool. And it's probably helped you to know that you had kind of those fans with you rooting for you.
Well, it was really funny because as we played further into it, you could feel the crowd. You could feel that they were as much for me, if not more for me, than Tiger. And, I think the world of golf felt the same way that we did as players. You know, I mean, Tiger had said, I won the golf tournament with my C game at one point. At one tournament, he made that statement, and I totally understand what he meant by that. You know, he meant I didn't play my best, but I managed what I had really, really well. And, that's a lot of what golf is managing whatever you have. I mean, the best players in the world, they don't hit it perfect all the time. They just manage what they have. Tiger did it as good as anybody in the world.
Yeah. It's, it is, I guess it's a little bit difficult for people to go back in that time and picture being someone other than Tiger, being obsessed with Tiger, because we just look at it as so iconic and monumental. But like you said, when somebody's making comments like I can win with my C game and here you are, you've been a top 10 player in the world for I think over 100 weeks in your career, and you're out there probably like a lot of the other guys thinking like no, it ain't that easy. Like, we're out here to play too. We can play some golf. So yeah, I mean, I imagine it's a little personal on some level.
It is. Tiger was always, I enjoyed playing with Tiger. I mean, every time I ever played with Tiger, I looked forward to it. In my opinion, my career spanned long enough that I played quite a bit with Nicklaus. He was in his, late 30s and early 40s whenever I played with him. But, and then it spanned long enough that in Tiger's early years, I was playing with him. And they were completely different kind of players, both dominant but different. I get asked all the time to explain the difference between Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods. To me, Jack Nicklaus knew his strengths. He had a great inventory of what he could do. He knew his strengths, knew his weaknesses, and managed both, played into his strengths and away from his weaknesses. Tiger is the only guy that I've ever played golf with in my life that didn't worry about the next shot. No matter where it went, he knew he had that shot. Now, that must be fun to play golf like that.
The most right, fun. Like I'm currently in the midst of trying to do this Breaking 100 series where I'm working on my game all the time, and I don't know where any shot's going ever. And I feel like anywhere that I end up now that I'm trying to get this new swing and implement it into my game, I don't know if I have any shot. So to have the complete opposite feeling of that, to be like, I'm going to hit this ball as well as I can, and no matter where it ends up, I'm going to have that shot. I think he's maybe the only person in history, him and Nicklaus maybe, but him in particular, who has had that feeling where it's fine. I'll be able to hit this ball no matter where it goes. That's incredible.
Yeah, I'm not sure Jack had that. I think Jack had some shots that he didn't really want to put the ball in. And I think Tiger's walked up to every shot saying, I've hit this shot before in my life and I'm liable to hit it again right here.
All right, we got to talk about some new technology, which is 4D technology. I imagine you guys saw this of my golf swing at the U.S. Women's Open in four dimensions, which is one more dimension than I knew was possible.
Yeah, it was something. That was.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And if you want to break 100, I'm going to give you some advice, Trent. You ready for that?
Please.
Block one side of the golf course out. No matter how bad that miss is, you have got to only deal with one side of the golf course. Okay. So I have no idea what your swing looks like or anything else, but if you can get it going one direction, you can manage it. That you've heard me use that word several times, manage. You got to get it manageable, and that's block one side of the golf course out.
I think that's very strong advice, and I think I would avoid a lot of trouble if I'm able to even implement that part of the time, because right now it's just I'm all over the golf course. I see parts of the golf course that no one else has ever seen, and it's just I never know necessarily where it's going. So I think that's something very much I need to keep in mind.
What level of golfers does that apply to? Is there a threshold where you just stop playing that way, or should every person kind of take that approach when they're trying to become better?
The best players in the world have blocked out one side of the golf course. And when that side of the golf course is in play, they're having to manage a lot of different things. You know, they want to make it effortless, and their eye will only see one thing. So that applies to every level of play. If you can block out one side of the golf course, you've got a much better chance of scoring.
What happens? So let's say I block out the left side of the golf course. I'm a lefty, right? I want to hit everything with a draw, and I want to play the right side. What happens when I pull up to a fairway that has all water on the right side? What am I going to do mentally?
You're a lefty?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I knew that was coming. I felt that coming all the way from that.
It's not as bad as it used to be because they're finally making some good-looking equipment for our
lefty. Right, they really are.
Yeah, they really are. They are. So here's the truth. In my game, I'm a right-handed player, and I really wanted to block the left-hand side out. And, you know, I hit a draw with my irons, and I faded my driver a little bit. You know, I tried to block the left side out. That's the side you're wanting to bring into play. I'll tell you this, that hook has got that face shutting down, and it won't listen. It doesn't have ears. So when it gets wild and mad – you can't talk it down. It's going to scream out of here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's just like a lefty draw. It's just the most beautiful thing, I think. Like when I'm striping my irons and I'm striping my drives and it's going left to right, everyone is oohing and ahhing on the tee box. There's something about that dinky little fade to me. It's like I don't want to do it, but I agree. I think I should choose one side. But my question remains, what do you do when that side that you've blocked out – you can't block it out. You must go to that side. Like, is that like you just like adjust there? Like, what happens to your plan there?
Well, I mean, there's been times in all of our careers where our intentions are good, but we can't seem to do it.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, to me, I talk about commitment to a lot of the kids that we talk to all the time. You know, you got to get committed to a goal, a plan. And, you know, I played golf my whole life with a plan. And when I didn't have a plan, I couldn't execute. And I think better players need to have a plan of some sort and then never hit a shot that they're not committed to the shot, whatever their plan is.
Yeah, we hear that. I feel like that's one of the most common things when a player on TV doesn't hit a great shot. It's like he wasn't committed to that shot. You know, well, like, obviously on a general level, I think people – like, oh, yeah, I know what that means. But, like, it's not like he wasn't – like, he pulled the club back and hit the shot. So he's clearly committed to doing it. So what, you know, for you, like, on a little bit of a deeper level, someone that's, you know, again, has a phenomenal resume, major champion, took down Tiger Woods, like, what does that really mean for someone to be committed to a golf shot?
So let me give you an example. So let's say you're in between clubs. You pick the clubs that you're in between and you're on the tour and your caddy is talking to you about it. And, you know, the way we hear people talking about shots now between caddies and players, it's pretty interesting really, because my caddy, Freddie, never had that much interaction with me. I didn't want that much interaction because that could cause confusion. So it's even more important today that they finally decide on something. So Freddie and I had a little inside pack. If I put my hand on one club, keep your mouth shut. if I put my hand on two clubs, then that means I'm in between clubs and I welcome what you think. So whenever he would tell me what he thought, if I went that direction and it turned out to be wrong, he needed to take responsibility for that. Because if he didn't take responsibility for that, then I'm still thinking about that shot, what the mistake that we made while I'm trying to hit the next shot. So I've never really fully gone to the next shot because I'm still processing the last shot that we hit. But let's just say that I chose the club that I wanted to choose and he had tried to talk me out of that. When I pull this club, I've got to be committed to the shot. An example of that was in 1986. I was in the last group with Greg Norman at Shinnecock. He and I both were, it was on Sunday afternoon, and we get to the par three on the front nine late in the round seven or eight. I can't even remember what hole it is. I pull six iron out, and I've got the lead at the time, and my caddy can tell I'm not 100% sure of what I'm doing. He picks up the bag, sets it between the ball and the green. He said, go on and hit it, boss, if you can. I mean, imagine the last round of the U.S. Open, and that's what your caddy does to you. And I backed off, and I'm like, what are you doing? He said, man, put that club back in the bag, and when next time you pull it out, commit to it. Whatever you do, commit to it. It was a great lesson for me to learn at the time. And, I mean, I wasn't certain of what I was going to do. So I did commit to the shot. The wind came up, knocked it down in the front bunker, and it buried. I went to the shot, hit unbelievable shot out about a foot from the hole and maintained the lead. But see, once I had committed to it and I knew I did the best I could, I can move on to the next shot rather than keep thinking about the last shot. So important.
Yeah, I mean, it's a phenomenal story, and it is a good lesson, I think, for all golfers of all levels, because there is – We joke a lot about how we don't have a plan. Like, though, you know, we don't know how, we don't have great swings, we don't have great touch, whatever. And we just, a lot of times you step up, you just, we're all about pace of play, we're trying to play quickly, we're having a good time, somebody's listening to music, and you hit a shot, and afterwards, immediately afterwards, we are just like, man, I had no plan there. I didn't know what I was trying to do. I didn't even really know what club I was hitting, what the exact yardage was. And so, I mean, it makes sense in a game where you need to focus so much that having a plan and committing to that plan is going to be so important. And it sticks out to me. I mean, you and Freddie, you know, must have been as close as you can be to have that kind of relationship under the gun.
Well, we did. And we had a great – he caddied for me most of my whole professional career. And, I mean, what we're talking about right now is so important to the game of golf. There's so many people that you can work with on your golf swing. But there's very few people that you can work with on your mind. And it's so important to me, and I think it's so needed, that I'm fixing to start this new thing called Let's Talk Golf. And I'm going to let people get into the mind of people that have played great golf. I'm going to have guests, my friends on, and so that people can interact with some champions on what they thought and how they thought it. And you know, I think the easiest way for everybody to improve out there is stop thinking about your golf swing and start thinking about the inventory of what you can do and start managing what you already have. No one is doing a very good job of that.
So where can people find this? This Let's Talk Golf. Where are you going to be? How are they going to be able to listen and hear and watch you and get back?
Well, it's coming. Our first night is going to be June the 30th, and we're going to have a Zoom call just like this, and people will be able to type their questions in, and you know, here I am doing exactly what I'm doing right now, and I'm going to be talking to everybody about it. So if you follow us on Twitter at Hal Sutton Golf, you'll see all the details coming forward, and Instagram both, Hal Sutton Golf.
Talk me through what the shot, you know, we've talked about it a little bit, but 72nd hole, Players Championship against Tiger Woods. I believe you're 179 out. I think you end up hitting a 6-iron. Like, once you've pulled that club, what goes through your mind before you strike that ball and you have, you know, the be the right club today? Is it a swing tip you're reminding yourself? Is it a commitment thing? What are you saying to yourself in those moments between pulling the club and hitting the shot?
Well, really not a whole lot. I'm not saying anything. I'm actually – I'm trying to let my mind be as quiet as it can be. And the best shots in the world are when you're quiet in your head. And that means you're committed, and that means you're not thinking about a multitude of things. And, you know, but it goes way back beyond that. You know, Freddie and I had already decided if I had the lead on the last hole, just a one-shot lead, I had hit 3-wood on 18 all 3 days before that, aiming out to the right, hitting 4-iron into the green and stuff like that. I knew Tiger was going to hit his 2-iron stinger, and I could not hit my 3-wood past his 2-iron stinger. So I told Freddie, if we get to the last hole, we've got a one-shot lead, I've got to hit driver because I got to have the last shot into the – I got to do whatever I got to do. So, you know, Tiger, he eagled 16. I don't know if you remember that or not. I had a 3-shot lead. He eagled 16, and I parred. So we go to 17 with a 1-shot lead. And so he had the tee on 18. He hit that perfect 2-iron stinger down there. So it's driver time, you know. So I hit the driver exactly where I was trying to hit it. So I went to the shot with a lot of confidence. I had drove it perfect all day long. I did miss one fairway. I drove it on 16 just in the edge of the right rough, and that's why I didn't go for the green. And, you know, the whole thing was a plan. You know, I just executing the plan. And that's what every great football team does. That's what every great baseball, basketball team, they have a plan and they try to execute the plan. And golf is no different than that.
It's really stuck out to me too, you know, the different generations and the different, you know, stars and eras of the game even that you played through and that you played with. I mean, you mentioned Jack Nicklaus, you mentioned Greg Norman, everybody knows Tiger Woods. You know, to you, how much has the game changed from, you know, 70s, early 80s to, you know, even now, because you've had a front row seat to a lot of it?
Well, it's changed a lot. You know, the distance factor has changed a lot of things. You know, when I was out there, you know, accuracy was most important. And, you know, it's not that distance wasn't important, you know. We just need to – I felt like I was a better player out of the fairway than I was out of the rough. But now everybody hits it so far, they got short irons into the green out of the rough. And, you know, I think – you know, I could say I wish the USGA had kept a better handle on all this, to be honest with you, because it's cost the consumer billions of dollars from equipment to renovating golf courses to bring them up to standards. We've got some golf courses that were incredible golf courses that, you know, you can't play anymore because these guys hit it too far. And, you know, we didn't have the policemen in the game because they were afraid of litigation. They were afraid the manufacturers were going to sue them, and they went to sleep at the wheel, and guess what happened? The manufacturers took over. And to be honest with you guys, what happened is they sold distance. The manufacturers did, like, they addicted you to distance. They've addicted everybody to distance. We have kids that come in here, and we're talking to them. You know, they're wanting to know what their swing speed is and how far they hit it. You know, I keep trying to tell them, you do know that at the end of the day, all they ask is what you shot. That's all you got to sign. They never tell you how far did you hit a tee shot. The rest of the world is worried about that, but low score wins, not longest drive.
Now, Hal, on my side, so do you think that it ended up being good for the game of golf, though, to get these kids? Is there something natural about wanting to hit it the furthest, about wanting to have your car go the fastest, about wanting to hit the furthest home runs, the most home runs? Like, you saw the boom in the MLB with Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire. It was the best thing that's ever happened in the sport. Is there a part of you that thinks, like, this actually did help the game of golf? Maybe not the actual game, the way to play it, but, you know, the general sport and playability of the average man or woman?
Well, it didn't help it near as much as the pandemic did.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I mean, to be honest with you, before the pandemic came along, you know, golf was there were fewer golfers playing than ever before. Now, the demographics, the age demographics, I guess, are probably different. You know, there's a lot of youth in the game now, which is good. But, you know, I'm excited about how many people love the game again. There have been people come back to the game that had left the game. And, you know, and then we can thank the pandemic for that. It has nothing to do with how far a guy hits it that happened. And, you know, I love watching the ball go a long ways. I wish I could make it go a long ways. I'm going the wrong direction. It's getting closer to me instead of further from me. But I'm 63 now, so, you know, I guess I have that right at this age.
Most guys have tried different ways to last longer in bed. Those ways do not work. Curling your toes, I believe, is one that I think I've tried before and I've spoken about trying before. Not curling your toes, because if you try not to curl your toes, somebody told me that that would work. And then you're in a weird situation where you're, you know, having sexual intercourse. You're excited about that. You're like, oh, I'm going to try this new technique of, like, not curling my toes. And then you realize that it's just not working. And now you're in a whole house of horrors. So you don't want that to happen.
Well, Jeff. And, yeah, we've talked about different ways. I think I've talked about maybe glaciers, I think, was one of the early ones that we would talk about. And then you start to think about what you're actually trying to do. And what you are doing is actively taking yourself out of the moment when you're supposed to be enjoying the moment. That is the main piece of that. So you're doing the sex. That's an exciting time. What a time to be alive. You awesome. Did it. Congratulations. But then then I'm going to spend that time thinking about glaciers. Like, that makes no sense. I'd rather be thinking about what's going on in the moment while not getting too overwhelmed.
There you go.
Right, but sometimes the moment is just too much. You know, the moment is what gets you to build up, where you got to curl your toes. Or
but
potentially you just think about your own body, because your own body is just disgusting. So,
but you know what? No, you don't think about anything. You don't think about you stay in the moment, and the way to not get too overwhelmed is to use Roman swipes.
There you go.
That's correct, Trent. They're a clinically proven way Roman swipes to last longer in bed. Effective, easy to use, fast-acting, Roman can ship swipes to you in discreet, unmarked packaging, and each swipes packet small enough to hide in your wallet. Whenever you're going to need it, pop that out, use it, boom, you can last longer. You don't have to ruin the moment by thinking about Lurch's gross body. Go to GetRoman.com/4. You can get your first month of swipes for just $5 when you choose a monthly plan. That is GetRoman.com/4.
It's funny you say that, because one of my questions was going to be, you've obviously played for a long time in your life, and we have a lot of listeners, which I tend to forget, that are, you know, of the older demographic. I'll have people come out to me at golf courses, and my dad's one of the biggest listeners of the show. So what would you say to someone that's growing with the game, growing older while playing, and how to adjust to your game? Like, how have you had to do it, right? Because you go back to your 20s and your 30s, you have a different swing. Is it different swing thoughts? Is it a different mindset? How would you talk those people through how to go out there and play?
Well, first of all, I'm going to say this one more time, an inventory of what you do. Let's be honest about what you can and can't do. The second thing is, get with a group of guys that play the correct tees. You know, my ego in the old days, you know, show me where the back tee is and tell me what the course record is. And that was what interested me. Now, my ego is not so big. I don't need to prove anything to anybody. I want to go out there and enjoy the game. And let me tell you what's enjoyable. Making a birdie. Mm-hmm. Have y'all ever made a birdie? Trent, have you ever made a birdie?
I have, yeah. All right. Going to stun some people. It's probably going to stun you too, but I have.
Okay, good. All right. So, so you know what's fun about the game. When you made that birdie, it was fun, right?
Oh, I felt that juice. Yeah, I like that juice.
Absolutely. Well, that's what's fun. But if you play the incorrect tee and all you do is feel like you've been in the ring with Mike Tyson all the time, you're not going to stay in the game, you know? So, you know, I think everybody needs to come to grips with what you can and can't do and play the correct tee that will allow you to feel good about yourself when you leave.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a great point. And you sometimes see, you know, an older guy, I'll be playing with my dad or his friends, and I'll be playing the blues or the blacks, and they're like, there's that thought of, oh, like, do we want to go up there? Because they're men. They're my father. They're older guys. But they end up going up there, and they have a great time. You know, they move up a tee or two. And like you said, instead of having the 180-yard shot that they feel like they couldn't really hit it onto the green, they have a 150-yard shot. And now they're able to place around to the green and maybe make a birdie or two for the day. You go home. You have a great score on the scorecard. You have your beers and your cigars, and you're done. That's all it should be at that point.
Well, at the end of the day, this is a social game that we compete in. And the biggest who we really compete with is ourselves. And, you know, if you can find where you're comfortable at and live within that range, I think you have a better chance of enjoying the game.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you talking about the distance thing, right? It is funny that, like, you might get a little bit of instant gratification out of hitting a bomb and hitting it way out there, hitting it further than your buddies. But, like, you see it all the time where people mess that up or they make a bogey or double from it. In reality, what's really fun is, like, hitting it in play, hitting it straight, hitting it on the green, like, playing golf well, I think probably keeps people coming back more than, you know, just hitting a few really, really far. Because golf, when you're playing well and you know, you've got looks for birdie and you could string together a good round of golf, is, I mean, I think that's the most fun thing in the world, is when you're playing pretty damn good golf.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt about it. Going back to Tiger and I that day, Tiger, I drove me on almost every hole. And the great part about that is I hit the first shot into the green, and I never let up on the accelerator. So I kept – see, there was no open – the only open spot was on 8, and I kept the pressure on him, so he had to hit a good shot. And, you know, so you don't have to be the longest. You can keep the pressure on your fellow competitor if you hit a good second shot into the green.
So, you know, we got to fast forward about – 4 years to the Ryder Cup in 2004. You're the U.S. Ryder Cup captain, and you make the bold move of pairing Phil and Tiger together, which I love. I think all the clips from it are it's just such a memorable move. And talk us through, you know, that entire experience of pulling that move, all the media that went around it, and, you know, your thought process on it.
Well, there's a whole lot to this. And first of all, you know, Tiger and Phil weren't the best of friends at the time. And, I mean, I don't think they were enemies, but they just weren't buds. And, you know, I analyzed that. And I go back. Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson weren't the best of friends either. They were competitors. And they played 12 times with each other at the Ryder Cup, and they were 11-1. So there was a precedence for this sort of thing. And I remember telling Jackie Burke and Steve Jones were my two assistant captains. And I brought Jackie in because I didn't think anybody at that juncture knew Jackie very well. And I thought Jackie was the brightest guy in golf at the time, 85 years old, but he knew more about golf than anybody I knew. And then Steve Jones, I brought him back because he wanted Oakland Hills, and he had been had elbow surgery and everything else, and it was kind of a tribute to Steve to get him back involved. And we had a talk, and I said, you know, I'm really tempted to do this, put them together. And neither one of them were real big on doing it. I said, you know what? I said, let's just suppose that they play great. If they do, I never left a Ryder Cup match where I played with someone that I went to war with them, that I didn't leave there a better friend with them. Win or lose, I was a better friend with them because we had tried to accomplish something together. And I said, if they leave better friends, golf is the winner. And that was the justification behind it. And, you know, the first match, they got beat, I think 2-1, if I remember correctly, and they were 9-under after 11. So it wasn't like they played terrible. Like Colin Montgomery and Padraig Harrington just played a lot better than them. The second match, Phil didn't play very good. And, you know, Phil, I could go back and tell you a lot of stories about that, but Phil was angry with me because I didn't tell him who he was going to play with. He wanted to know who he was going to play with. And I said, Phil, as soon as I know, I'll let you know. And – you know, he switched balls and club 2 weeks before we went up there. And on Wednesday, he tells me he's not even going to play a practice round because he didn't know how far the ball was going to go. He said, I got to go over here and try to figure out how far this Callaway ball is going. And then he badmouthed me and said I didn't give him time to get used to Tiger's ball. He didn't even come up there with a ball that he was used to and even understood. And see, I took that on the chin. I didn't say anything about this for a long, long time. And it really, I quit the game after that. I left after that. 5 years, I didn't play golf. I was so disgruntled with everything. And, you know, I'm sharing this with y'all now because, I mean, Phil and I are fine. We're friends. But, and I sent him a congratulatory text for winning the PGA. But that was all mishandled. every bit of that was mishandled. And, you know, when you work hard on something for a year or two, like you do the Ryder Cup, and it's a thankless job, my dad begged me not to do it. He said, Hal, he said, there's no upside to it. If you win, they get all the credit, all the players do. If you lose, you get all the blame. And how true is that? Absolutely the truth. So
it's very true.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I was really put out with golf for 5 years. And I didn't want anything to do with it. And it's something that I love. It's something I've done my whole life. And finally, I got over it. I said, you know, I'm going to go back and play. And by the time I went back and played, my hips were locked up. I had arthritis in my hips. I've had both hips replaced. And now I've had my left knee replaced as well. So there's no more competitive golf left in me, but I still know a lot about the game.
It's, man, it's really encompassing of all the worst parts about media, you know? And like you said, the fact that it's so thankless, the fact that people break it down when, you know, the captain, you didn't hit a single golf shot. It's like if you put guys out there and the other team plays better golf, the other team's players hit better golf shots, your team's just going to lose. And that's what it comes down to. And yet, you know, people, they want to drag captains. They wanted to drag you. They wanted to drag Tom Watson. They wanted to drag all kinds of people for you know, even on the other side, like Nick Faldo, when he didn't win, they wanted to drag him. And it's like, no, the players are the ones that hit the golf shots. It's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. You know, the Ryder Cup, I loved being there as a player. I played on four Ryder Cup teams, and, you know, I had a winning record. I mean, I'm one of the few Americans that is alive today that says that could say they had a winning record. You know, it's been my favorite thing in golf was being on the 99 Ryder Cup team. We came from so far behind, and, you know, it's one of my fondest memories that I look back on and think, man, I'm so glad I was part of that. It was so electric. Never been in a sporting event for golf that was more electric than that. Anyway.
Man, that's been such a consistent answer from players that we've talked to that have been in Ryder Cups. It seems as though that's every player's favorite memory or top two or three memories playing on a Ryder Cup team. And I always wonder if it's because of the team aspect, right? Like, you guys are out there on your own. You got to make your own dollar. It's a tough living being a professional golfer, and finally you get to get guys where they have your back, you have their back, kind of a locker room mentality, right? Is that why that adds to that, and obviously the country, playing for your country, but it's been such a consistent answer. It's amazing.
Well, I think playing for your country is a big part of it, but also I think the fact that this shot not only matters for you, it matters for a lot of other people. You know, golf is an individual sport, and if I fail, I only fail myself. But in the Ryder Cup, you fail a lot of people. And I think that's what's so important about – that's why we love the Ryder Cup. I think it's one of the greatest sporting events that there is. You know, the media center at the Ryder Cup, there's 1,500 people in the media center at the Ryder Cup. It's bigger than the Super Bowl. And, I mean, a lot of people don't know that. But, I mean, you go into media center at the Ryder Cup, you will be shocked. And it's a big deal all around the world.
Yeah, it is. It's it's funny because, you know, we do, even as fans, we take the Ryder Cup on such a different level than you take any other golf. Like, you know, you and all your buddies that are all American and from the same country, like, we're all geared up in red, white, and blue, and we're part of the team. So it's the feeling, right, that, like, oh, yeah, this is our event, like, we are going to win, whereas on a normal tournament, there's no we. It's you're out there, Hal's out there, Tiger's out there, Ryder Cup, we're all playing as a team.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, you go to a normal golf tournament, you have your favorite, that's who you're pulling for. You go to the Ryder Cup, you have your favorite team, and that's who you're pulling for. And you're pulling for everybody on that team, and every shot matters. And, I mean, there's nothing like the Ryder Cup in golf. That is... To me, that's the ultimate.
Yeah, they made the right decision moving it, for sure. Like, you couldn't have had that with no fans. The Ryder Cup with no fans just isn't a Ryder Cup.
No, that's right. That's exactly right. So I'm glad they moved it. It should be spectacular at Whistling Straits. You know, the risk-reward there is pretty pretty profound, and I think it's going to be a great Ryder Cup course.
With golf season in full swing, Chevy wants to help you make the most of every drive, and the all-electric Blazer EV's bold design and dynamic performance make it the perfect electric vehicle to get you to the course in style and comfort. Chevrolet, together let's drive.
Is there truth to the fact that when they're choosing venues, they'll actually choose it based off of how the team they think is going to perform the best, right? We've heard like rumors and speculation that captains will, they'll all get together and that's like how they'll choose the course or the layout.
Money talks. Trust me, it's the biggest moneymaker the PGA of America has. And they're looking for where they think they can have the greatest competition and do quite well financially from it. So
I'm glad we got that cleared up, because you hear it all the time. Oh, they in France, they had it because these guys were more target golfers and the USA wasn't going to be able to compete with them. And,
so,
and Whistling Straits, we're going to be able.
I'm not sure how the Europeans do it. I do know that the captain has the ability to influence the setup of the golf course, but I don't think he has the ability to choose the venue.
Now, when you did you have your hand in the way the course was set up, and
I tried to influence Kerry Haig to set it up the way I thought it should be set up. And I one of the things at Oakland Hills is really, this is really a funny story. So after the first day, we've got walkie talkies and headphones on, and I radioed Steve and Jackie Burke, and I said, well, we got to set Tiger or Phil. We got to make a statement. And I said, I've got my opinion on who we're going to set down the next morning. I said, I want y'all to tell me what y'all think. And this is so funny. Jackie Burke said, well, hell, Hal. He said, if you got any guts, set them both. And I said, no, we can't do that, Jackie. I said, but why do you say that? And he said, we don't have a snowball chance in hell. He said, every American's trying to play every shot in the air. And he said, the Europeans know how to use the ground to maneuver the ball. At Oakland Hills, you got to use the ground to maneuver the ball. He said, everybody, you were standing on the ninth tee telling everybody to hit it left of the flag and let the land move the ball to the right. And he said, I don't know what the attraction to the pin was, but all the Americans were firing it right at the pin. And we lost the hole all day long. So, but here is the reason for that. The Americans are a product of their environment. That is the way we play golf. That is the mentality that they use every week. That's how they make the living that they make. And so the arena that they play in, that's the way they play. Now you go play in Europe, it's a whole different story. They use the ground to maneuver the ball. They land it over here to make it go over there. And, it's just different game here than it is over there.
It's interesting. We were in Australia for the President's Cup, and we remember on the first hole at Royal Melbourne, they were actually, the international team was flying it into like that marshy, high, rough stuff, and they knew that it was going to come running out of it and go right onto the green. And we actually were so close to the tee box, we were able to hear guys kind of talking about different types of shots. Like, oh, did you see how hard that ground was? And did you see how they were running it? It was amazing to see. And it is interesting, the differences when you're in another part of the country, the world, how you could just play the game completely differently.
Yeah, I never enjoyed going over to Europe that much to play golf, just because, I was in this arena here, and we travel so much, I just didn't want to be a world globetrotter, and I stayed here and played a lot. I think I only played in 10 British Opens, if I remember right, and I could have played in more. I just didn't go.
it's your choice. It's probably smart. You're like, no, I fly the ball in the air. I'm not going over there playing links golf. Why would we do that? I have to mention too. You've obviously had a lot of success, in the game. And I just want to give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the good things that you've done with that. I know you received the Payne Stewart Award in 2007 for your charitable efforts. The children's hospital in your hometown. You've helped kind of spearhead and raise millions of dollars for hurricane relief. So, you know, how important is that charitable kind of, the bone in your body that you've had clearly throughout your life to help others? Because it's awesome. It means a lot.
Well, I don't think I was there in the beginning, to be honest with you. I was chasing my own selfish dreams. And I think what ends up happening after you've had some success and you realize that that's not everything that you thought it was going to be, that there has to be more to life than that. And then being able to do something to help somebody else is pretty darn rewarding. And, probably the thing that I'm the most proud of is being recognized with the Payne Stewart Award. You know, every year I go to the Payne Stewart Award and listen to the speeches of everybody that's won it and how overwhelmed they are that people see them in that light. And, you know, all of the people have accomplished great things that have won the Payne Stewart Award, but they will tell you emphatically that helping others was what really was gratifying to them.
It's awesome. It's just
that's great.
It's cool to hear that perspective from somebody again that's had a lot of success and you know, feels like it comes from the right place. So, you know, thanks obviously for all that hard work. That's amazing.
Well, I appreciate that. But you know, talking to all the kids out there, you know, there's never been a really successful person that wasn't selfish to some degree. And you know, it took people around them allowing them to be selfish instead of telling them what they're not doing all the time. And you look at anybody that's ever performed at a really high level, you know, they probably had to be pretty selfish to get to that point. And the best part of it is through the evolution of time and having wisdom come from all your successes, hopefully you graduate into that, I need to give something back. And I see a lot of that in the guys today. That part of it, you know, I really, what Justin Thomas did for Mike, Big Mike, was pretty cool thing, to be honest with you. And, you know, I see a lot of guys giving a lot of things back. And, you know, I'm proud of golf for what that's doing.
Yeah, it is. It's cool. The JT story was awesome. I mean, people don't really realize what it takes to make it, how hard it is, how expensive it is. So having those funds is huge.
Well, and so few people actually make it too. And, you know, so when they do give back, that's pretty cool. You know, there's so many people. You see the stars. We see everybody that's making it. But for everybody that's making it, there's 100 that's not, or 1,000, whatever the number is. And, you know, those guys are spending money. They still love the game. They're still trying. You know, Big Mike had been trying for a long time, you know, and finally got in a tournament, you know, and he was, you know, it was a pretty cool thing.
Very cool thing.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, we appreciate it.
I'm sorry. Wait, I have to ask one question because, you know, with the players, we got into a debate and we talked to Will Zalatoris about this. We're going to talk about a 10 handicap here in this scenario. If you're talking to a 10 handicap player, which hole would they have a better chance at making a better score? 12 at Augusta or 17 at TPC Sawgrass?
Ooh. Well, in my opinion, I think 17 at Sawgrass, you'd have a better chance to have a better score. And here's the reason why. It's kind of out in the open. What the elements is doing is no mystery to you. Number 12 at Augusta, I think I played there 17 or 18 times, and I never knew for sure what that wind was doing on number 12. So to stand over, you know, that may be the one place that consistently I wasn't 100% committed to the shot I was about to hit because I didn't know what was going on there.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, that's fair. We've heard both sides. My debate was always you have more room for error, or am I saying that the opposite way? There's less room for error, more room. Whatever. You can hit a bunker. You can go long. You can go short. You're not going to be wet. I think if you get the shanks, if you get the chunks at TPC, good night. Like, you're never getting that thing on that island.
Well, that's true. That's true. But I can tell you, if you shank it on number 12 at Augusta, you're not going to have a good score. Trust me.
All right. That's great.
Thank you. That's what I needed. Howie, honestly, we appreciate it, man. We appreciate you taking the time. I know it's late. We made you go back to the office, which, again, your office looks awesome. So that's good.
Well, no big deal. I've enjoyed it. Hey, being on y'all's podcast was an honor for me. You know, we've got our podcast started now, Be the Right Club Today podcast, and I know the effort that goes into it. So I appreciate what y'all are doing, and you know, being on here was an honor for me.
Any final words on Trent and on his pursuit to break 100? Because this is a hot topic right now. So I got to get gassed up. I want him to get gassed up.
I don't know, Trent. Let me get my email and I'll send you some tips that they don't hear about, so that you can get better and say you did it on your own. I gave the one on here where block out one side of the golf course. There's a little more to it. So
listen, all right. First of all, I'm going to get your email for sure. And well, the series is breaking 100. That's like the poll. That's what people want to see. But the real goal is to beat the other guys on these screens here. So
okay.
I appreciate you giving out the one free tip to all three of us. But when you and I, we'll exchange some emails and I'll get the secrets and we'll be well on our way.
There you go. I'll be looking for the email.
Yeah, so Riggs and I have secretly just been taking all the tips that he's been getting so that we can improve our scores. Because the day if we just sit back, I'm going to end up being the fourth on the podcast in scoring.
He's just going to close the gap. Like that's just science. Like he's just going to be better than we are.
Yep.
Well, look, we appreciate it. We really do. Go check him out, Hal Sutton Golf on Twitter, on social media. You've got Let's Talk Golf coming out soon, and Be the Right Club Today podcast. So. Hal Sutton, major winner, legend in the game, 14-time PGA Tour winner, and now you've been a guest on the show, so we appreciate it.
I appreciate you, Riggs. Thanks.